So it's about only last week or so that I got a message telling me what my title is. So that is the title, The Fate of the Big Bang. And since I'm not the director of the institute, I cannot just change it. Neil has just completely changed the title, right? He's not speaking of the Big Bang. Okay. I just want to say that things that I'm going to talk about are not my work. I contributed, but there are many, many other people who have contributed to that particular work. Okay, so first I think I would just begin with the universe, what we know about the universe. So the universe according to Planck, what do we know about it? And this I think also sort of is relevant to several of the questions that have come up so far. So using the Planck data, we can determine the space-time to the future of the CMB epoch. So here is a conformal diagram. So if you like, this is us, some observer, and going from the Big Bang in the general relativity up to infinity. And from Planck data, we can just start with the CMB, and we can deduce from the data that it has given us what space-time structure would look like to the future. And the striking feature here is that because of the cosmological constant, or dark energy, the dynamics of the universe is such that there is a cosmological horizon. So even if the observer stays forever, actually cannot see all of space-time. So this is very relevant to all of us because we have been talking about infinite volume, finite volume, et cetera, et cetera. And therefore, as far as observations are concerned, at any given time, we're just going to see finite volume. This is a conformal diagram, so those of you who are not in kind of general relativity, I just want to say that this distance up here, this is the spatial dimension up here, they are completely misleading in conformal scale. Because the scale factor is changing here, in fact, the distances are increasing up here. So the CMB, for example, this is only about 17 megaparsec. Today, it is about 5 gigaparsec. And then here, but then the cosmological constant dominates. This is another important point. So that, in fact, these distances up here remain approximately between 5 and 6 megaparsec forever. So this doesn't keep increasing. This is an important point for various various calculations that people do up here. All right. Now, the striking feature for me is really that what we're seeing here is that the early universe is extraordinarily simple. There's also a point that Neil made in his introduction. And the distinction between what the theory allows and what is realized in nature, I think, is really essential for all our discussion up here. And we should sort of keep that in mind because we're talking about cosmology. Cosmology is not the same as quantum gravity. It is application of quantum gravity or general relativity to a specific context. Of course, our universe is very important, but what we study is only the large-scale structure. So various things that we talk about are what is relevant for the large-scale structure. That is what we talk about in cosmology. And so, for example, just for concreteness, let us suppose we consider the inflationary scenario. And with the Starobinsky inflation, for example, the onset of inflation is when there is a certain observational pivot mode. That mode actually, so to say, is physical wavelength exceeds the curvature radius at that particular time. And that curvature radius during inflation is very small. It's only about 10 million Planck length up here. And then we get here, because of our exponential expansion, this then fills out this region, and then this is the part which will be ever observable to an eternal observer. Where here, this is what is observable for us, but for the eternal observer. And now, during this inflationary time up here, the curvature is about 10 to the 65 times the curvature at the horizon of a solar mass black hole. So if you just take general relativity, you would say, oh God, it's such a huge curvature. All kinds of complexities are relevant, et cetera, et cetera. And it's true. In general relativity, if you consider solutions at that level, then all kinds of things will happen. But our universe is extraordinarily simple. Again, I would like to make this distinction between theory and a particular solution, which is relevant for the large-scale structure of the universe up here. But of course, we cannot go back and continue using general relativity, because in the Planck epoch, general relativity fails, because it ignores quantum effects. Again, we are normally used to thinking that quantum mechanics is important for microscopic systems, atoms, and elementary particles, et cetera. But in fact, we see manifestations of quantum mechanics in the sky. For example, the neutron stars would not be possible unless there was quantum mechanics. It is a Fermi degeneracy force which is quantum quantum mechanics, that makes these huge objects possible in the sky. And for the early universe, quantum mechanics is absolutely essential. So therefore, what happens before the Big Bang is really something that is really important, or what happens near the Big Bang is really very important, because Big Bang is a prediction of general relativity beyond its domain of applicability. Now, in physics, normally, we don't advertise predictions of theories which are beyond their domain of applicability, but for some sociological reason, we seem to be making an exception for Big Bang, and we keep talking about the Big Bang. Of course, one can, by Big Bang, one might just talk about some later epoch where the universe becomes hot again, etc. But literally, singularity is not a physical thing. Okay, so now the question is the following. So quantum gravity theory is one of the primary responsibilities would be to sort of understand what is the physics in the Planck domain, and does that physics then resolve the Big Bang singularity? So these are some of the questions that any quantum gravity theory should address. First of all, I mean, we assume that Big Bang singularity would be resolved. Most of the quantum gravity community assumes that. Then is there an extra input, such as a new boundary condition, like the Hawking-Hartle boundary condition, or introduction of some matter fields which violate energy conditions necessary to resolve the Big Bang singularity? Now, one would not want, I mean, if you do not want this, then the question is, what is the quintessential feature of quantum gravity that is going to overwhelm general relativity, the strong field region of general relativity near the Big Bang, and resolve the singularity? What do we mean by singularity resolution? Very often in the literature, particularly early literature, people say, well, I got a wave function. The wave function vanishes at the scale factor equal to zero. For the non-experts, what is important is just the geometry and the matter field. For the geometry, the variable is scale factor A. And for the matter fields, it's just denoted by this phi up here. So the usually people often used to say, I don't think they say it now, that this is equal to zero. But that is unlikely to be sufficient, because you know, this is all based on our quantum mechanical intuition, but really, we have to know what the inner product is, what the observables are. What we ought to know is, do physical observables become finite, remain finite, or do they become infinite at the Big Bang? And similarly, WKB type of approximations, which are widely used, are not likely to be very useful for this question. In the later epoch of the universe, yes, but not near the Big Bang. But what is the nature of the Planck regime? What does time evolution mean? This is the problem of central issue of this particular workshop. Do we only have quantum state psi and the operators? So just like what we had, or not something like what Sean had, except that he did not even have general operators, he only had the Hamiltonian. Or is there also an effective space-time metric which is dressed by suitable quantum corrections in this Planck regime? Do quantum corrections that tame the Big Bang, the singularity, can they accumulate over the cosmological timescales, causing undesirable departures from general relativity predictions? Now, the point is that, as was discussed quite extensively this morning, particularly by Andrew, what we have is not just the geometry, but we also have to think about the perturbations and how these quantum perturbations propagate on the classical background geometry. And these perturbations is what, as Andrew explained, gives rise to the last scale, to first of all inhomogeneities and anisotropies in the cosmic microwave background, and then the large scale structure from there. So therefore, if in fact we're going to Planck regime where we do not have a classical space-time metric, we only have a quantum space-time metric in some way, I mean some wave function up here, then can we do quantum field theory for these matter fields on a quantum cosmological geometry, not a classical curved geometry, but quantum sort of curved or cosmological geometry? And then are there observable implications in the new Planck dynamics? If in fact the Big Bang singularity is resolved, there's new Planck scale physics that does, and are there these observables? So these are the kinds of questions that we want to understand. And I will just comment about these questions just because of lack of time. And we had a lot of discussion on arrow of time. And these issues will hopefully come up in the discussion. Namely, what happens to the arrow of time? Are they physically motivated initial conditions? So this is the issue of the past conditions that we would like to impose, we would like to introduce, that were discussed in great detail up here. And for example, Roger Penrose suggested this wild curvature hypothesis.
Do you have a quantum extension of that wild curvature hypothesis? There's a lot of work that has happened in the last couple of years which actually addresses this issue. And this work also addresses the assertions that were made several times by several people up here. Namely, say, for example, in the inflationary scenario, we really don't know what the initial conditions are, et cetera. And what happens to the Iroff time? Are all the general solutions allowed in quantum gravity maybe not be relevant, because we just need to look at the solutions which came from this preferred the past conditions, the past state. Now what I would like to do is to just give you some illustrations of these answers that have come. There has been a lot of progress over the last 10 years in quantum cosmology. And I'm going to just use, I cannot in this time tell you what is happening in every approach. So I'll just give you some answers from loop quantum cosmology. But several of these considerations extend to other bouncing scenarios. So the first question was, do we need an extra input in order to resolve the Big Bang singularity? So in loop quantum cosmology, we do not need new boundary conditions, and we do not need matter fields which violate energy conditions. So then what is it that resolves the Big Bang singularity? So in loop quantum gravity, has a specific quantum Riemannian geometry. And what happens is that this quantum Riemannian geometry creates a brand new repulsive force in the Planck regime, overwhelming the classical attraction. And therefore, the Big Bang is replaced by a Big Bounce. The new feature is the Riemannian quantum geometry of loop quantum gravity. And it turns out that there is a fundamental microscopic parameter. It's just like in the theory of superconductivity, your fundamental microscopic parameter, which is the energy gap, the energy that is needed in order to separate a Cooper pair. I don't mean the analogy is perfect up here, but qualitatively there is similarity. And this energy gap then dictates macroscopic parameters such as the critical temperature. So similarly, in quantum gravity, there is an area gap, smallest non-zero eigenvalue of area, and that quantum geometry, that discreteness, actually makes the energy density in all possible physical states, not any one specifically chosen one, but in all possible physical states, bounded above by a constant divided by this area gap cube. And the number then turns out to be about half Planck density. What do we mean by singularity resolution? Well, there is a natural, well-defined scalar product on the space of physical states. So on the space of the solutions to the so-called Wheeler-Levitt equations, a la loop quantum gravity, that is to say solutions to the quantum Hamiltonian constraint, there is a natural inner product that comes from a well-defined mathematical procedure. And then we have a complete set of Dirac observables. These are the physical observables, the physical inner product on the physical Hilbert space. And those complete set of Dirac observables, for example, like the density and the curvature, which actually diverge at the singularity in classical general relativity, these observables have well-defined upper bounds on their eigenvalues, their spectra, have well-defined upper bounds on the entire physical Hilbert space. So singularity resolution actually has been analyzed using the Hamiltonian methods, path integral methods, and the consistent histories framework. Yeah, it is resolved because there is a brand new repulsive force that comes up, right? It's a repulsive force, but it's not put in behind. It's something, it's a surprise. I mean, we did not expect it. And we can talk about it in more detail about where that comes from. Then what is the nature of the Planck regime? I mean, what does time evolution mean? Do we only have quantum states and operators, or is there also an effective space time? So first of all, the states which are sharply peaked at late times. So what we do is the following. The Hilbert space has all kinds of states. Look at a state which at late times is sharply peaked on a classical Friedman, Lemaître, Robertson, Walker geometry. So classical solution of Einstein's equation. And you orbit back in time. And the non-trivial thing about this evolution in loop quantum cosmology is that the state remains sharply peaked. Now this evolution, what do you mean by time in the Planck regime? Well, this evolution is the relational time evolution, and I think Carlo is going to tell us much more about it. So the statement is basically, it's not that there is actually a clock and there is a classical metric, but rather, I'll just finish this maybe. Rather, we're just talking about a scalar field, which is really playing the role of a clock up here. And then the statement is that there is actually this well-defined evolution, and the peak of this wave function actually obeys effective equations which incorporate quantum geometry corrections. The effective theory and the wave function undergo bounds at this, this maximum density that we had up here. And finally, do quantum corrections that tame singularity accumulate over cosmological time scales, causing the undesirable departures from general relativity predictions? And the statement is that this has been analyzed in great detail. There literally are thousands of papers on this, so all kinds of models have been analyzed in great detail, analytically, numerically, approximation methods. And what one finds is that the curvature becomes completely negligible, the corrections become completely negligible when the curvature falls below about 10 to the minus 4 Planck curvature. I can explain this precise statement if there is interest. And it is really the repulsive force of quantum geometry origin is strong enough to overwhelm the classical attraction in the Planck regime, but it dies very quickly. So these are the questions that I answered up here. And now there is also a question about can we do perturbation theory? Yes, there is, over the last 5 years, very detailed quantum field theory on quantum cosmological spacetimes on the wave function side. These wave functions has been developed, and that is what is used in very detail. And then are there observable predictions? And the statement is that, yes, there are observable predictions coming from loop quantum gravity. This morning, we saw the plot of the EE correlations. And the statement is, but if you looked at the plot carefully, they're only for L much bigger than 50. These observable predictions are going to be at the longest wavelength scale, at the largest angular scales. And Planck is supposed to actually publish the data for the small Ls pretty soon. And then one can see these predictions are not made using loop quantum cosmology and certain conditions for the initial, certain assumptions about the initial conditions, the past state. And if, in fact, these conditions, so if the observations can falsify this, so one of these things may have to go, or it will remain. So it is good science to worry about what happens in the Planck regime. Thank you.
Questions? So I saw Neil first. Andy?
So if I could ask one question and then, I'll make one point and then ask a question. So the point is, you say psi equals zero at a equals zero is unlikely to be sufficient. It seems to me it's much worse than that. If you impose psi equals zero at a equals zero, you force yourself within the context of mini superspace to have a real wave function, or a wave function that's equivalent to real. That means you cannot describe an expanding universe. Yeah, that's a pretty big problem. Secondly, the only conserved norm on the space of wave functions is the DeWitt norm, and that would be exactly zero for such wave functions. And thirdly, in a paper we've just published with Stefan Chielen, we showed that imposing this condition forces a departure from a correspondence principle. So for all these reasons, I think that boundary condition of just setting psi equals zero doesn't really make any sense.
I agree. I mean, we have much more detailed discussion that doesn't resolve anything.
But why don't you say it a little more strongly than that? It's not a realistic theory. You say unlikely to be sufficient. I mean, it seems to be clearly wrong.
I agree, unlikely to be sufficient. I know, no problem.
I'm happy to put the seams in there, but it certainly seems to be clearly wrong.
Okay. The reason I put seams there is following. This is all in the Friedman, Lemaitre, Robertson, Walker mini superspace approximation, right?
Right.
And I was not particularly referring to, in this particular sentence, to Friedman, Lemaitre, Robertson, Walker case. Now, what happens in various other, I mean, I
no, but you must be, because just to talk about A, you probably have to be in Friedman, Robertson, Walker.
I first said that this is geometry and this is a matter field. Phi was not a scalar field. But let's not.
We agree. Okay. All right. So, secondly, I'm very curious about your predictions at Lowell. You say you have a falsifiable theory. I want to see the predictions. So, Can you explain what they are? And when Planck announces its result, are you really going to say this approach is dead if it disagrees?
Yeah. So, as I just said that this okay, let me not say it. So basically, the predictions are the following. I mean, I was going to explain why they come about, but we don't have time. Maybe in the afternoon, if we have time. So basically, the predictions are the following, that if I take loop quantum cosmology and look at the power spectrum, you find that the power spectrum is actually lower than that of the standard Bernie Davis vacuum. These come about because you start with certain preferred state, which has to do with the quantum generalization of Weyl curvature hypothesis. And that I have to sort of explain. Of course, there's not enough time today. You get a certain preferred state. You evolve it. And it is actually Bernie Davis vacuum at the onset of inflation for the high L modes, for the high K or for the high L modes.
But the low L TT is not going to change. I mean, it's the EE is going to change.
Right. Very good. So the statement is that this is something that we know. And this is the thing that we're
But there's no about. Prediction for EE here?
Yeah. So here is a prediction for the TE correlation functions. Yeah. Here the suppression is very small, but there is there. But as you say, the EE is important. The mm-hmm. reason for this is because for the TT and for the TE, there are other explanations. For example, the explanation which have to do with the late history of the universe. People have proposed such explanations. But they do not get, none of that I know of, will get a power suppression up here. So there are very clear, these are all
well, work. It doesn't look like they're going to be statistically significant.
Right. So that is a question, whether they're going to be statistically significant. Okay. But that is a second point. I mean, namely that Lamb shift was not statistically significant for a very long time. So I don't buy this as
But we can't overcome this one.
We are theoretical physicists. Right. There's no cosmic invariance limit up here. But I mean, I don't know. I mean, so the question is whether this is distinguished or not. But there are predictions. That's what one is making up here. And then you have the second part of the question. If this is not found, then what happens? And then the statement is that there are two inputs up here. There is a standard loop quantum gravity cosmology input, and there is an input about what the initial state is. So then I would definitely say that these are the two inputs which led to this conclusion, and therefore one of these two inputs has to go away. Of course, at this stage, the weaker input is the boundary conditions, the initial state that we're given. That is a generalization of Weyl curvature hypothesis. And actually, but I like it because this is very much in the spirit of this discussion up here, because it could be that this is something in between. Roger gave some idea that is crystallized here in terms of certain precise statement about the structure of quantum field theory. And then, but of course, it's still a hypothesis, right? This is still something that one is actually imposing on the initial state. And the question is whether something like what Lee and Marina and Enrique are doing, or some generalization of it, some other version of it, actually leads to this. So this is giving all these people a concrete hint as to what one should lead to.
Okay, so Andy?
So I gather you're talking about a bouncing universe, although you didn't really make much of that in the presentation. I'm particularly curious about the entropy. Can you plot that as a function of time through the bounces?
Yeah, So I don't know what entropy of what.
Sorry.
Entropy of what?
You put the plot and tell me what.
So of
the system of, you know, all the degrees of freedom.
So there is actually, there are two things. The first of all, the statement is that if I just put the Friedman, Lemaître, Robertson, Walker background, there's a bounce, and then if I look at any.
So have you put matter region, in?
Yeah.
So
there's matter.
So, but
I think there's something that we've discussed.
We know the entropy. So if it looks entropy like the Big Bang,
right, as was
we
told
know what the
before.
Entropy does.
Yeah.
Then what happens to?
So now I have to do some coarse graining for me to obtain. So the Tolman calculation tells me that entropy is conserved. Let me just sort of tell you the thing that you probably won't hear. Okay. So the statement up here.
Tell me what I want to hear.
Okay. So maybe it's not, but I just sort of I wanted to make this, I think, precise because the answers depend on exactly what the question is. So one possibility is the following, right? I mean, that in ordinary for Friedman, Lemaître, Robertson, Walker universe, there are no cosmological. There is no what is technically called dynamical horizon, marginally trapped surfaces, which are outer marginally trapped surfaces. But it turns out that in this Planck regime, when the equations are modified, these horizons develop. So one could associate an entropy, which is really the area of this horizon, which includes everything together. It's a long discussion, but well. Then the statement is that in the past branch, as you're contracting, the entropy, this horizon actually expands out, and then at the bounds, it fills the whole universe, whole space that appears. So if you like, the entropy becomes infinite. And then this horizon just disappears in the future bounds. This is a geometry calculation that has been done in great detail. So from this perspective, then, one would say that, well, as Penrose at one stage saying, that we have to reset the entropy clock at the bounds. And then again, you see what happens.
If it didn't go to infinity, the area didn't go to infinity, you couldn't reset the entropy.
So I don't know what reset means.
The dynamical horizon disappears in the future.
Right, and then you can talk about another horizon.
You could talk about the entropy of this. Yeah, you could talk about that. Right.
But can you interpret that statistically? We're talking about the arrow of time.
Okay. So then there's the issue of complexity or something. So in the now what I'm telling right now is recent work. So in those calculations, if you look at the perturbations, right, in detail. So with these boundary conditions, actually, with say Starobinsky potential or M squared phi potential, or Starobinsky in particular, you actually get a good agreement of the data. In fact, I just show you something. In fact, you can even do the chi-squared fit, and the chi-squared fit to the data is better than the standard Davis vacuum prediction. But then one can say, what is happening to this in the past? So in this particular case, it turns out that in the past, there are not enough e-folds. The boundary condition that were given up here at the bounds, they don't give me enough e-folds in the past. So it looks like that, in fact, there is no structure formation until there is actually an inflation that occurs up here. Now, there are many, many different variations of this.
So
I just
so what about in the future example. Bounds? Maybe another way to ask the question.
So I'm looking for other questions because I think I'm feeling that this is getting into too much details. But, I mean, if there are no other questions.
So you look and I'll talk.
Yes, okay.
Does your boundary condition that you've chosen specially repeat itself bounce after bounce, or is it disappears just in one place?
There's only one.
So our cosmos is one bounce out of infinite many.
Okay. Zhao? There you go.
I was just wondering how much of these relies on the assumption of quantum gravity, how much of it is the model itself, and how much of this could be applied, for example, to just thermal fluctuations in a bouncing universe or whatever.
So the thing is that, you're right. I mean, you already did some work about this some time ago with the thermal fluctuations. I think what people have done, this is why I said, well, it's difficult for me to answer in 2 seconds because there are a lot of different work up here that to add this question. And particularly, for example, this work of Edward Wilson and people in Brandenburger's group, which look at matter-dominated, just matter bounces, right? So there's no inflation or anything, there's matter bounces up here. And the statement, but they use the physics of loop quantum cosmology there. So it doesn't really have to do with the details of this particular model that I have talked about just now. Of course, various details are different, right? I mean, when what happens to structure and such thing, and I can happily discuss that with you. But this diagram is particularly, this suppression, et cetera, is really within the detailed framework that we have worked out. But the quality features, the bounds and the structure formation in the future, they are actually preserved in this other work as well. So what is being used is, you know, how do we make the past branch and the future branch joined to each other through the quantum regime, and there one is using the loop quantum cosmology geometry to join the two things together, or loop quantum cosmology wave function.
What would be really cool is that if the bounce caused, for example, a background of gravity waves that was completely distinct, like, for example, couldn't be anything else. It had to be like the emergency parameter, whatever. These would be like quantum gravity in the sky. And unfortunately,
This is something like quantum gravity in the sky. I'm agreeing with you that there are two different issues here. I mean,
fixing your chiral gravitational wave. You guys should also look at TD and ED, the forbidden, so-called forbidden correlation. You look at this, it's just for certain values of the frequency, you get a bigger TB than you get BB.
In other words, that would be, that's truly quantum gravity.
Because it's cool.
Yes, yeah, everything is, but I think we want something that can be traced back to the, which is used some the parameter, H bar, explicit G.
Right, so I want to abuse for a second my position as chair. So, I mean, you had a choice of potential for the inflation, so you could change that choice and then you get different predictions, right?
The reason that we are looked at in greater detail Starobinsky potential is just the hope that maybe, you know, if we look at, understand full quantum gravity in much more detail, then in fact the correction will come with the higher, I mean, in the effective theory, there'll be corrections which are of the order of higher Schliemann curvature thing. And that would be like Starobinsky potential. But I want to say I'm not wed to inflation, I'm not wed to any particular scenario. We are exploring the implications of quantum geometry, as I told in answer to John.
Wonderful. Rafael.
First, I just had a short technical question. When you said dynamical horizon, is that defined by trapped surfaces?
Yeah, or so the
it's not a, it's not an event horizon.
No, no.
Okay.
It's just marginal. It's space-like.
Okay.
It's space-like. And as time goes on, it actually expands. And then
so we don't know the connection between that and entropy for event horizon in this context, because we don't have.
Yeah, but on the other hand, for
the
dynamical horizon,
energy conditions,
there is also the first law of mechanics has been proved exactly. In fact, it's better than for the event horizon because it's actually quantitative, not just that the horizon area increases, but one can actually show that if it is expanding out, I can take a cross section here, I can take a cross section here. Ask how much is the area increased and related to the flux of energy and angular momentum across up here. So you get actually finite version of the first law. When you take the limit, when the two surfaces are very close to each other, then you just get the standard first law of black hole mechanics.
But it doesn't apply about across this bound somehow, or at least the entropy increase.
No, it doesn't apply there. Yeah. The reason is because the dynamical horizon just disappeared in the future.
I mean, personally, I think the event horizon is. But anyway, that's another issue.
That
we can discuss. But
yeah, we have difference on this.
The question that I had that seems more connected to the overriding topic of this session, this meeting and the session is, where are you going to set boundary conditions? If I understand the picture of the cosmos you have is it's infinitely big or very big and maybe infinitely big, it contracts, it bounces, and then it goes off to infinity. And that's the whole story. Now, there seem to be two options. One is if you take time as real or the time, I mean, if you want initial conditions, they're actually when the universe was infinitely big. On the other hand, if you have a different sort of time symmetric view, you might want to set the boundary conditions at the bound. So do you have a comment on those options?
This is something that we looked at in some detail. So the statement is that we can put the condition at the bounds up here, right? I mean, and this was when we were first doing the Penrose's wild curvature hypothesis. Right. You wanted to impose it on the singularity, but in quantum gravity is not. So the simplest thing is to impose it where the curvature is maximum, and that happens at the bound. So basically, we are looking at a Planck regime around the bounds, and I can explain to you much more, but basically imposing the idea that the expectation value of the electric and the magnetic parts of the Weyl tensor should be zero, the fluctuations in them should be equal, and they should be minimum.
You get a T-symmetric cosmos in the end?
No, you do not.
And well, then how did you get the time?
Because the background geometry is not. So this is for the fluctuations. Right?
For the fluctuation, but what about for the background?
So the background geometry is not T-symmetric. The reason is because for the background geometry, the conditions, I mean, one way to get the particular condition up here is to ask. There is a minimum area, I was telling you about the area gap. So you can take this sphere of minimum area. You cannot take a smaller sphere. This is an ultraviolet issue in quantum gravity, so in loop quantum gravity. So you cannot take a sphere bigger than that. You take the minimum sphere, and then if you ask, for example, that this minimum sphere expands out to the entire observable universe, I'm giving an example of that. So if you do this, then the statement is that actually determines here
what the initial conditions are, and those initial conditions are such that they're not time symmetric. In other words, to be time symmetric, you need the fields to be can be arbitrary, but all the time derivatives should be zero there, and that is not happening here. There are several other ways of looking. I mean, it's a complicated story.
We can discuss maybe later.
But. Sounds like some detail. So if there are no urgent questions, I suggest that we carry on until Neil's talk. Thank you.
For coming. It seems like this meeting is getting more and more exciting. So in view of the time, I decided not to talk about cosmology. I simply advertise a new paper, which is coming out in PRL, I think next week, with Stefan Chielen, called A Perfect Bounce. A Perfect Quantum Cosmological Bounce. And Stefan will be here tomorrow, and we're just in the process of finishing a long paper about this. There are some very simple assumptions that go in there. I think you won't believe how simple they are. But we show that with suitable analytic continuation, you can just avoid the Big Bang singularity. And quite what that means in terms of all the questions which have been raised in this meeting, I think we're still figuring out. But it's very interesting. You can really make progress without throwing everything, including the kitchen sink, into a model of the singularity. So that's just a brief advert. What I thought I'd talk about, since time is short, is something brand new, which is an outcome of a workshop held here over the past month on quantum foundations. And it was an outcome of discussion between Yakir Aharonov and Sandu Popescu and myself about the issue of unitarity in quantum gravity. So this is with these people. First of all, let me just remind you briefly of how gravity rescued quantum mechanics in the 1920s. And so there was this famous debate between Bohr and Einstein. And Einstein didn't like quantum mechanics. And so he came up with a thought experiment which would disprove the uncertainty relation. Okay, so Einstein proposed the following at the famous Solvay conference. He said, imagine there is a box with a pointer, and the box is suspended from a spring. And so we can measure the weight of the box using the spring. And inside the box, we have a clock. And the clock is able to emit photons through a little hole in the box. And what Einstein argued is that when a photon is emitted, obviously the box loses some mass and some weight. And so the box will rise due to the spring, and you'll see the effect on the dial. But the clock is what emits the photon. And of course, the clock will just record exactly when it emitted the photon. So by allowing yourself arbitrary amount of time to measure. Sorry. No. Einstein. Bohr is coming. I hold the Niels Bohr chair, I know. Don't tell me about Bohr. Okay. Bohr is coming. Einstein proposed this. Okay. So Einstein said, if you allow yourself a long time to measure the weight of the box before and after the experiment, there's in principle no uncertainty. And therefore, by inferring the mass of the box and hence the energy of the box, including its contents, you could make delta E as small as you like. But of course, the clock just tells you the time when it was emitted. So Einstein said, you can make delta E delta T as small as you like. And Bohr was extremely unhappy and went around complaining at everyone. This could mean the end of quantum mechanics. And then famously slept on it. And then in the morning came up with the resolution. And essentially at that point, Einstein gave up trying to show quantum mechanics was inconsistent because of this argument. So Bohr said, of course, just thinking a little bit more carefully, how do you measure the weight of the box? Well, you look at the position of the pointer on this dial. If you know delta x, then of course delta p, the momentum of the box, has to be bigger than h over delta x. But of course, weighing, so how do you weigh it? Well, the photon goes out, the box rises a little bit, and you compensate by adding a few coins on the top of the box to push the box back down to where it was before. And the weight of what you add, of course, is the weight that the box has lost. And so weighing requires that g delta m, if delta m is the stuff you added, which is times t, this is the time over which you took to add the stuff, that is the total impulse you give to the box downwards, and that better be bigger than the uncertainty in the momentum of the box, otherwise you won't see any effect of this procedure. And so, so you immediately infer that h is less than, Planck's constant is less than g delta e over c squared, because I'm converting delta m into delta e over c squared, t delta x. Well, that's not quite what you want, because you want a relationship between delta e and delta t. And now came Bohr's real stroke of brilliance, which is he said, of course, as this box goes up and down in the Earth's gravitational field, you have time dilation due to the Earth's gravitational potential. And so, so Bohr realized that delta t over t, the change in the rate of the clock, is nothing but g delta x over c squared due to the Earth's gravitational potential. And substituting that in there, you get h is less than delta e delta t. And voila. Yes.
Do you agree that this is the wrong explanation?
No, I think it's correct.
It is. And there's a long discussion in the literature. There are now papers explaining clearly
why this is OK, let's talk about it afterwards.
It's not. The mechanics is consistent also without grant,
right.
G equals 0.
Right. I mean, so how does the consistency of quantum mechanics depend on general relativity?
I refer you to Yair Aharonov's book, which explains this in great and gory detail.
But there's a later.
That's fine. That's fine. Their book is very recent. Okay. I'm not going to use it, actually. This is just a little bit of history. In fact, what I'm going to do in my talk is use gravity to, in a sense, destroy quantum mechanics again. Okay? Not really destroy it, but only in a certain limited sense. So this was just a reminder of the history, that actually gravity was invoked to rescue quantum mechanics. So my talk today, but yeah, I'm curious to know more about the history.
Yes, what?
What
do you mean in life, right?
This is not my motivation. This is simply a historical anecdote. But if you have an issue, yeah, take it up with Einstein and Bohr and Aronoff. I won't erase it. Okay. Do you take issue with it?
Oh, yes.
Okay. Very good. Okay. Well, maybe we have another discussion about that. What I'm going to talk about is the violation of unitarity in brackets and gauge invariants. With local clocks. Okay, so this looks very shocking. I do believe in unitarity. I do believe in gauge invariance. This argument is going to cast doubt on the existence of any reliable local clock. Okay, and I'll do it in a thought experiment. Let's imagine I've got a pendulum. Mass m2, position x2, and so this thing can just oscillate backwards and forwards. Now, let's send another mass past it. So mass m1, position x1, and it's just going to fly past. Okay, so pretty boring situation, you might think, except I'm going to use this coordinate. I'm going to do this in quantum gravity. And I'm going to use the coordinate of this traveling particle as the time. Okay, in gravity, there is no preferred time. And certainly, if you have the idea that you should use some kind of local variable as the time, this is the best you can do. So it's traveling past the pendulum. And so this guy is going to be the time. This is going to become the time, and I'm going to describe the quantum mechanics of this pendulum in that time. Okay, that's my goal.
There is no coordinate, there is no position in gravity.
So imagine there's a big ruler that sits here, okay, with marks on it. And that's what x1 means. And likewise, I can put some ruler here, and I'll put some structure there. Okay, that's what I have in mind. Okay, so any problem with this? Now, interestingly, there is. There's immediately a problem. Why? Because any clock has energy. Very simple fact about clocks. You can't have a clock unless it has some energy. Something's got to be traveling. And that makes it interact gravitationally with the system which it's measuring. And that inevitably creates a certain ambiguity about the quantum mechanics. So how we describe this is there's a certain Lagrangian which has become well known again due to LIGO and black hole measurements. So Einstein, Infeld, Hoffman. What they did is they worked out the effective Lagrangian for two masses interacting via gravity. And the motion of the masses gives them extra energy, and that changes their gravitational field, and so it changes the interaction between them. So the effective Lagrangian, if they're moving at small velocities and if gravitational potentials are weak, looks like this. Times 1 plus 3 gm2 over r. R is the distance between the particles. So this is r. And then I have plus 1/2 m2 x2 dot squared 1 plus 3 gm1 over r. And actually, there are a few other terms which are a little more complicated, that it don't change anything in principle, so I won't write them down. And then, of course, we have minus the potential of x2. It's some kind of pendulum or other system. It won't really matter what it is. gm1 m2 over r, that's the gravitational potential energy, and then minus m1 minus m2, those are the rest masses of particle m1 and m2. So you can derive this. In fact, these terms are very easy to derive from the Nambu action from the two particles. Okay, right, no time. So this should be quick. Let's write the Lagrangian as 1/2 gij, x dot gij is a metric on the space of variables, x dot I, x dot j. That's the weird thing here, is that the mass, effective mass, depends on position. Okay, so that's very important, completely generic in a gravitating system, minus the potential. And so the Hamiltonian, well, you see, immediately you have this, you have ordering problems. Ordering. Where do I put my p's relative to my q's in the Hamiltonian? Okay, there's an inherent ambiguity, and this will be the origin of the unitarity violation, which is unavoidable. Okay, so the Hamiltonian, so this was all considered by DeWitt, like many other issues in quantum gravity in 1956, a beautiful review article. And DeWitt only wrote 6 articles, I believe, in his Rev Mod Phys. Yes, I think he only wrote 6 articles in his lifetime. No, really? Less than 10? Not sure. Very few. Each one a masterpiece. Anyway, we really have to figure this out. Okay, so you have ordering problems. So DeWitt said the way you resolve those is by writing the measure on the space of coordinates as follows. Okay, because that's coordinate invariant. That's the coordinate invariant measure. And then demanding that things like the Hamiltonian should, operators like a Hamiltonian should be Hermitian under that measure. Okay, so the Hamiltonian, for example, is minus 1 over 2 g di, just the Laplacian, there's a root here, gij dj plus v, and I'll set that equal to 0 on the wave function. And similarly, the momentum is equal to g to the minus 1/4 minus I d by dxi g to the 1/4. Okay, that's the unique definition of the momentum, which will make it Hermitian under this measure. Okay, you need the g to the minus 1/4 factors to cancel this off so that psi star p psi is equal to integral root g p psi star psi. Now, as soon as you do that, you then solve the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. H psi is 0. You can choose x1 to be proportional to the time. And what you find, so then the solution turns out to be e to the I integral p1 dx1. This is the momentum of particle 1 in the gravitational potential times chi of x1, x2. And then chi obeys a Schrodinger-like equation to, so at in the non-relativistic approximation, you find the following, I dt chi, so this is the Schrodinger wave function in the time t is h2 chi. And then you have a funny extra term in the problem I mentioned. It's gm1 minus m2 dt 1 over r chi. So because this 1 over r term is changing, there's a term in the Hamiltonian which has an I in it, and that immediately tells you it's not unitary evolution. So you can infer that d by dt of integral chi star chi dx2 is equal to minus 3g m1 minus m2 over 4 integral dx2, sorry, d by dt of the expectation value of 1 over r in the system 2. Yes? Correct. Oh, I said x1 is the t. So I just picked the constants appropriately. I just use x1 as the t. So when you solve the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, you find that chi star chi is integrated over dx2 is not conserved. So in view of time, I won't show you the proof, but you can prove that the hermeticity of P, clock implies that the unitarity violations, in other words, these things, unitarity violation is local, meaning that it comes and goes. So if you integrate from minus infinity, where your clock comes in, to plus infinity and compute the change in this chi star chi, you will find zero. It's only at intermediate times that you find unitarity violation. And so what that means is this is completely consistent with the existence of an S matrix, which would be unitary. But it says that if you try to take a local view of time, you run straight into a big problem with ordinary quantum mechanics due to gravity. Okay, thanks.
Okay, thank you. So Lee has already spoken, so I'm going to go to Andy.
So the world is full of all kinds of things, most of which are crappy clocks.
Yes.
So why do I care? You found a bad clock. I mean, this is a bad clock.
There is no good clock.
Okay. So
if you include gravity, there is.
You've got this tiny little toy model, and there's no good clock. So what?
Well, what are you doing when you do quantum mechanics?
No, may I?
I'm doing it in the cosmos that has good clocks.
Andy,
let
me try to put this in the.
So in the cosmos, I could have this be the cosmos.
Yeah, you better choose a better clock.
No. I'll choose the region I can see. It's a big thing, but it's finite. Choose the whole region we can see, we'll still have this problem.
Well, let me put this in the context of the issue of the meeting.
Yep.
There is a long-standing hypothesis that the fundamental dynamics of the universe comes from the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, which is timeless.
Yes.
And that the time in the Schrodinger equation for subsystems of the universe emerges from the Wheeler-DeWitt equation by studying the coupling of a clock to some other local system. Sean mentioned this yesterday.
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm doing.
Okay. You are demonstrating that to the extent that we try to follow this program, we cannot get local unitary evolution purely.
Correct.
So if you want to be really provocative.
I thought I was provocative enough. But by the way, gauge invariance is also violated.
No, let's assume
it's completely general.
Let's just assume it's general.
How do you,
Andy, before let's decide if it's important.
Let's assume it's general.
Yes.
Okay. Then the provocative conclusion is that the original hypothesis that quantum cosmology is timeless and the time that we're used to dealing with in local systems and quantum mechanics emerges as the reading of a clock cannot be the case and should be abandoned. That's the provocative conclusion I draw from this work.
That's very provocative. I mean, what we're interested in are practical. Let me now be Andy. I'm not proposing abandoning quantum mechanics, but my inference from this is that reality is profoundly non-local at a deep mathematical.
But why not reject the Wheeler-DeWitt equation? What good has the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, in fact, ever done us?
It's a wonderful equation.
Equation. And some of us in this room have made our careers by solving it.
I think people, including DeWitt, became very disillusioned with the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, okay? Because it is very technical, it is very involved, blah, blah, blah.
No, it's beautiful.
I don't think there are good reasons why people, including DeWitt, became unhappy with the equation.
But the hypothesis that time, that the universe at the quantum cosmological level is timeless, and time emerges by looking at some sort of study like this of local systems, which could be clocks, is a long-standing claim, and your result stands against it. And I think I'm trying to be provocative enough that somebody... Carlo comes back and yells at me.
I would agree with you. I think a satisfactory notion of time cannot be given by any local system.
Sounds good. By you? Up is on. Okay.
I'm still stuck with your appetizer. Little tweaking will show that the time uncertainty is much more subtle. In the original example of Einstein, this clock was controlling the opening of a door for a short time such that the photon escaped. Put now the detector outside and put the clock next to it, something very interesting happens, and make the photons appear as more rare. Nothing happened so far, right? Because the photon did not come out. Wrong. You say that reality is profoundly non-local. Reality is profoundly non-temporal. Just as in position measurement, that the non-clicking of the detector just now localizes the particle, here the non-clicking of the detector should already suffice to make this superposed, something that nobody thought. This is the infamous non-photon. So reality is... also highly non-temporal, not only non-local.
Okay.
Even the most boring Borean should concede that. Thank you.
Even worse. Good. Very interesting.
Everybody agrees?
Well, I just wanted to support how Lee was criticizing the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. And I think Bianca was raising her hand, and she's probably wanted to say something similar. That is...
Bianca, are you going to criticize Wheeler-DeWitt equation? No, okay.
Well, look, rather than give the Wheeler-DeWitt equation a hard time, why don't you just give this Lagrangian a hard time? By the way, this this is good. Excellent. Excellent. But before we go too far afield, take this Lagrangian. This has been confirmed by observations from LIGO. This determines the inspiraling and the admission of gravitational waves. Take this Lagrangian, tell me how to quantize it in such a way that X1 will be a good clock. And I'm claiming you cannot do it.
I don't doubt that.
You don't doubt that?
Well, what I wanted to add is that the naive interpretation of the Wheeler-DeWitt equation and the naive quantization of the Wheeler-DeWitt equation usually prevents you from having good semi-classical solutions. And what I see in your example is precisely that. There isn't, at intermediate times, at finite times, you don't have time variable.
There are excellent semi-classical variables here. This particle is monotonically going along in space with we can discuss the math, but mathematically there is no question the semi-classical expansion is perfect in this situation. It's just no question.
No, I don't blame semi-classical analysis.
Okay.
I blame the Wheeler-DeWitt equation for not having...
But I'm just quantizing this system. Forget about Wheeler-DeWitt. Tell me how to quantize this system. I'm saying the way to quantize it is... more or less uniquely given by this expression. Any way you quantize it, you will run into these ordering problems. As far as I know, this is the only sensible resolution of those ordering problems. It gives a unique answer. And with that answer, there's no unitarity.
I would say, look, Neil, these things have been discussed for years and years and years in the quantum gravity community. So let me tell you what...
And what conclusion did they reach?
Yes, exactly. Let me tell you what I, Carlo, believe is the conclusion.
Okay.
Your math, I'm happy with your math. I'm not going to complain your math at all. Okay?
Sorry?
I'm happy with your math entirely. Okay. I think that what it's saying is that there are systems like this one, and presumably like the universe as a whole, where you can give a fully coherent quantum mechanical description that gives predictions on how probability, or what a probability distribution of measurement of certain variables given certain other variables in certain states. Mm-hmm. Okay? I've never mentioned the word time so far. So this is a consistent formulation of a theory of the universe where you have some observables, and you say, if this observable is this value, then this other this value. If I've measured this, wait. In some limit, and within some approximations, which can break down somewhere, these predictions can go to a classical system where one of the variables behave like what we call time in Newtonian or relativistic quantum mechanics, or in a Poincaré invariant quantum field theory. Mm-hmm. But the mistake is, it seems to me, and I'm aware I'm in disagreement with some of the people who say there, I'm agreeing with what you say. The mistake is to pretend that something which happens to be true in a limit where you disregard quantum gravity, relativistic, blah, blah, blah phenomena, still remain true in the full theory described by those theories here. Now, a different story is those kind of theories, will-o'-the-wheat, or what you say, actually describing the world. I think that the answer is more or less obviously yes. One have to do experiments. We don't have experiments confirming that. But as far as the coherence by itself of the theories is concerned, this is a perfectly coherent story of the world where you are not just supposed to talk about one variable as a time variable. You are supposed to talk about the relative evolution of variables one with respect to the other, and only in some limit one of these becomes as a time. That, I think, is a story that emerged from along the 3 decades of discussion in quantum gravity.
I'm not really understanding.
Okay, so are you just saying he chose the wrong clock?
Sorry?
Are you just saying he chose the wrong clock?
No.
He's really not saying that. I think there's a sharp paradox here. Okay, which I have not seen in the 30 years of work on quantum.
What is the paradox? That there are no exact clocks, no perfect clocks.
No, the paradox is that if I insist on this, on one variable being
yes.
the time, a local variable being the time,
yes.
I do not have a conservation of probability.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. No. It's not a conservation of probability. Sorry.
That seems
probability
to be a
is well defined. Probability is well defined. You don't have unitarity. Something else.
Integral psi star psi is not conserved. That's what.
Conserved in what?
Time. The time. Yes.
Is not conserved when you change one of these variables. Let me give you a much simpler story of this one. Take a pendulum in 2 dimensions. Okay? Mm-hmm. And you can locally use one variable as time, mm-hmm. and for a little while, in the quantum mechanic of this object, you have an almost unitary evolution as one variable changes.
No, this is a completely different
story. But of course, this doesn't
story.
Go
I
longer.
Picked a monotonic variable. That's a completely different
That's
story.
True in the classical theory, but it's not continuing in the quantum theory.
Let me interrupt this point. So I think you have to move on. It's very interesting. Well, I think that's
Bianca,
you wanted to make
Nayesh.
You said Bianca could go next. Yes, I did, but not anymore. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. There you go. Go ahead.
No, I mean, I agree to a large degree of Carlo, and actually, so my opinion is we should stick actually with the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, but I also believe that. I also believe that there are actually no good, perfect, or local clocks, and there's a number of works and arguments which we put forward. In this context, actually, because you say the variable is monotonic, so actually there's a work which Aharonov and Popescu were involved, showing that the time of arrival operator, which you basically use there, has specific properties and is a long problem actually to base really your clock on just x1. I mean, it actually has never been solved even for a free system, as far as I know. Now, what could happen here is, so that's one thing, that there could be some loss of unitarity either because the particle can actually also go backwards. Or the second thing is, but I'm not sure, is actually one has also to be careful of how to write this time evolution, because not every Hamiltonian, not every variable behaves as if there would be a symplectic flow. So one has to be actually careful there. And it looks like the extra term looks like that. That explains the non-unitarity, actually, even in much simpler terms.
I'm not sure that's okay. So the point I'm trying to make is that the clock has energy that causes gravity and introduces terms to the Lagrangian, which are not minimal. And
no, that's a nice example.
Associated ordering problems.
Yeah, no, that's a nice example of a time-dependent physical Hamiltonian, so that makes it more non-trivial, but there could be even, I think there could be even something that you try to time-evolve time itself, because you have R in there, which depends also on your clock. So, but that's a technical dangerous point. That's, you know, it looks, because you have a time, the time derivative of your R variable there.
Yeah,
I can explain. It's a technical point. I can explain later, actually.
So, and is that similar to Carlos? Okay, Philippe. So just to mark something for tomorrow's discussion, Carlos Klein, my dear friend Carlos Klein, assumes that the solutions of the Wheeler-DeWitt equation have by themselves, without some notion of time, a good interpretation.
Lacking a notion of time, lacking a notion of unitarity because there's no notion of time. And therefore, the challenge to you for tomorrow morning is to provide us and flesh out that fully consistent theory of the interpretation of the solutions of the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. Because that's what your claim rests on. So let me just bracket that for discussion tomorrow.
Okay, thank you. So let me see, I think I don't know your name. You're talking to Bianca. Hello. Do you want to make a point? No? Yes.
So,
go ahead.
It's a bit of a technical question, but is
The Lagrangian that you wrote down, it is not relativistic. So it's not invariant under reparametrizations in time. So I was wondering why there is a Wheeler-DeWitt equation in the first place.
Yes, there is. So this can be derived from an Hamiltonian action. So if I write square root g mu x dot mu x dot mu dt, that's the action for one particle. I put the metric in. I do this for particle one and particle two. And there's a little bit of a subtlety, which is you need to also include the Einstein term, which is in the non-relativistic limit, gives you phi squared v squared phi. You couple these together. And so this metric sources phi. So one can derive all of this from. Actually, the terms I can't derive are these ones. The actual Einstein-Minkfeld-Kaufmann is a little bit more complicated than this, and there's no simple derivation I know of other than using effective field theory and integrating out gravitons and so on. But these terms arise very simply, including the factors of everything.
Okay, so maybe the last point Raphael could make, and that we should then move on.
There's a long-standing argument whose details I don't remember, but maybe someone here will remember, that says, even without considering gravity and considering locality, that there cannot be a good clock in quantum mechanics, just from energy conditions, just from the fact that the Hamiltonian should be bounded, what?
Energy is quantum.
Yeah, from the fact that the Hamiltonian is bounded below, it already follows that you can't have something who's with a variable that evolves monotonically in time. I think it's related to what Bianco was saying. I wonder how that's related to this.
I think it's a totally different point. I mean, my unitarity violation is proportional to the
But could this be a special? Right. So could it be a special case?
Due to gravity, but you know, it's related in some way. But this shows you violations of unitarity.